Just a quick review. The two main images we've worked with so far are the fire and the oscillations. As synchronicity would have it, a friend of mine sent me a beautiful little, oh, kind of a short essay on fire. I thought I'd read it to you. It says, you know, poets really need to interpret dreams, not therapists. It really does a nice job of talking about what's at stake when we're dreaming of fire. And it's called Burning Clean. It's just about a page long. I don't know this person, Bondu Scott Dunham. I Googled him. I don't know him. And you might know him, but he's an glass blower in the Southwest.
What's his last name?
Dunham or Dunham. D-U-N-H-A-M. It's called Burning Clean. The burn is that feeling you get when you are most alive. It is the opposite of boredom. The burn is happening somewhere in the universe, and when we are most alive, we feel it, we connect to it. The rest of the time, we are numb to it. The burn is what we feel when we are passionate, edgy, when we are on the line, when we are inspired, when we are at risk. So think about Pali and all this stuff, what the fire is trying to communicate to him. The best human beings are those who can stand the burn the most. People are afraid to burn because it's uncomfortable. It is not safe and predictable. Feeling the burn means to embrace the ball-crushing mystery of life. People who like to burn sometimes seem crazy to conventional society. They are too creative to be managed easily. The burn is about being juicy. It is about having eyes ablaze with something that can't quite be put into words. There's nothing as glorious as a huge fire. The burn makes you squirm in your seat sometimes because it is really too big to hold, too hot. It stretches you, burning down the walls in your psyche so that you can see what life is about. That's why it is so uncomfortable. That's why artists are sometimes edgy and irritable and crazy. The burn hates interruptions. Everything that's disgusting about conventional society is based on trying to keep the burn under control. The burn is about knowing instinct, doing what you know, feel is right, even if it doesn't fit into somebody else's plans for you. Feeling the burn is about blazing a new trail. Even though geniuses and creative people have been living the burn for thousands of years, it is always new territory. You are different than anyone else who has ever felt the burn, so you will burn in a different way. You have a personal destiny that you will discover only by burning. Only by facing the fire and withstanding the heat of it. The burn will talk to you if you are brave enough to meet it face to face. That's why Native Americans do sweat lodges and vision quests. They know that only by living according to what burns the hottest can a person be happy. I think the purpose of human life is to let ourselves burn completely. To live according to a vision, to manage keeping that decision to burn every minute. People who can do that are incredible. I've been lucky enough to meet a couple of them. For most of us, life is about approaching that, getting as close to the fire as we can, and feeling the burn more and more. It's not about being perfect all at once. It's about listening to what life is telling us and responding to whatever calls the loudest or most persistently. It doesn't matter what you do as long as you are burning clean. Burning is an intense focus. As you concentrate sunlight with a magnifying glass, you get a fire. Burning clears all the debris out of your life. Life refining gold in a furnace. All the crap just burns off. Burning is the only cure for suffering in life. Burning is a discipline, self-discipline, like the discipline not to lose your cool when you're climbing a sheer rock wall or busting in air, like the discipline to do your art according to what you know is beautiful for you instead of worrying about what other people will think, like the discipline to not lie to your best friend even though it would be easier. Self-discipline is what enables you to carry out whatever vision you have. Discipline is what enables you to live on the edge, to feel what burns the most. Sitting with a dream can make you edgy. If you have a dream, but it is not yet a reality, it makes you burn. Sometimes you have to act on dreams right away, and sometimes they need time to come into being. You might need to burn internally for a while to gather force before you can act effectively or proceed strategically to make the vision happen. The burn of wading through lines can be agonizing, but it is worth it. And it is an investment that will pay off. It will make you stronger, give you inner substance, and the ability to receive an incredibly powerful presence. It is concentration, thoroughness. Burning clean is about being thorough, leaving no traces, no ashes. It is the kind of focus that takes up everything into account so that there are no mess-ups. It can start as something small in your life that you use to gain power. When I'm at my workbench, I have a habit that gives me power. At the end of the day, I always put everything away. All the tools go back in the rack and the table is neat. I don't do it because my father would like me to. He always used to yell at me for leaving his tools out. I don't do it to please anyone. I do it because it makes me burn just a little bit. I found that it also makes me a more powerful worker, and it saves energy in the long run. Who would have thought you could learn anything about the burn from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Basically, being a nonconformist is about being willing to burn, to blaze new trails instead of going around in circles like a conventional zombie. Burning clean is about being effective as a nonconformist, actually living your life as you see fit instead of fantasizing about it. Burning is a hard discipline, but the alternative is to go to your grave knowing that you blew it somehow. Nothing is worse than living a life without a dream. Keep the fires burning.
Dunham. Oh, Dunham.
But we could say Burnham.
Yeah.
Slower.
Yeah.
Is it D or B?
D like dog. D-U-N-H-A-M.
Yeah, okay.
Bandhu, B-A-N-D-H-U. Scott, S-C-O-T-T. Dunham or Dunham.
Is this from a book?
No, a friend just emailed it. You know, right after we were talking about the fire, so... the dream we left off with, I'll draw, and just as you let you interpret it. Who wants to recount what the first real piece of unconscious material is that we're dealing with here? Remember it.
There's a window on the clock.
What was the window about? No?
The conscious orientation,
yeah.
Outlook?
Yeah, it's looking out on life, so it's about his outlook on life. And what's missing? On the next image on the right, we would apply some of our hypothesis.
Time is not complete.
Right. His concept of time is incomplete. And what's missing is the for lack of a better word, the vibrational or the oscillating nature of time, that there are really two dimensions to time. There's time and space, but it's intersected by moments in which it appears the infinite makes itself felt. In a word, Jung's concept of synchronicity is based on this idea. Moments of time are not all the same. And you get that in the Greek with Chronos and Kairos. That all sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other thing was there was a woman, dark woman, crying. Because she had either had written or wanted to write a book. I forget. She is crying because she wants to write a book but cannot find a publisher for it. There is a great deal of material on time symbolism. Now, we're going to be looking at the dark anima, the light anima, the dark shadow, and the light shadow. But just for the moment, I think we can say that Pali is being addressed to actually direct his creativity to writing and speaking about some of these problems. The dimension of time that is not included in our contemporary Western standpoint.
Is it significant that symbol of time that there's three parts and that four would be the
yeah. That's how she reaches there. He reaches the conclusion that there's an aspect of time missing because we would expect four. Mm-hmm. He's got three, so that the fourth is down below. Those waves are the fourth dimension that he excludes. And then there's a statement that the definite hours have to be paid for with the definite life, and the indefinite hours have to be paid for with the indefinite life. Which I would take to mean the definite hours would be the hard work you have to do on the unconscious to make yourself aware of what it's asking of you. And the indefinite would be opening yourself up and having a view of life that is open to and responsible to these moments when coincidences, quote unquote, occur, when you are being redirected by events in the outer world. And for him, of course, the big event will be a meeting with Von Franz. By the way, I talked to Dave, the guy who wrote that Pali Jung book, and asked him about the letters, and he thought pretty sure it was Pali's wife that destroyed Von Franz's letters. Yeah, because she was not too happy with the whole thing. So that's why we don't have them. And that takes us up to page 21.
I have a question when you're done talking about that.
Sure.
Go ahead first. Okay. In the middle of that bottom paragraph, where it starts the healing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. I guess we better start it. Anyway, he talks about. I'm going to start a sentence ahead of that where it says against.
Why don't we start? Let me read you the passage.
Yeah.
Remember where we left off was the oscillations means that reality is a process. And Pali wants reality to be a state. He doesn't like the dynamic nature of life. He wants to be able to control and wants the world to be something that is controlled. We'll be talking more about that. So what the author did was says, yeah, and look, Einstein said the same thing. And we talked about that on page 19. The Einstein. I read you the quote from Einstein. What motivates science? And he says what motivates art, but I don't believe it. Is this desire to reach a steady state above the chaos?
That's motivation for art.
That's what Einstein says.
Okay.
Yeah, Einstein is saying what art and science does, it creates a position of stability. People enter a world where there is stability over against the chaos of life. Certainly it's not true for art. We just heard an artist say the opposite. But that's what Einstein is saying motivates scientists. And of course, our point of view, he's going to be presenting is that's just nonsense. That's an escape from life. And that's part of the problem of science. It does try to transcend the dynamic nature of time. Scientists in trying to get above in an ivory tower. To find constant laws rather than to be subject to the vicissitudes of emotional chaos. That's what Einstein said. And then then where we left off was Schrodinger's opinion on this kind of thing. Schrodinger is one of the other big players in making quantum physics. We haven't talked about him too much. The three people who did it in Copenhagen, remember, were Pauli, Heisenberg, and Bohr. And Schrodinger was working in Zurich before Pauli got there, and he added a constituent to that quantum theory. I don't think we need to be too much aware of it, but what he did was try to discuss the wave nature of particles. We could worry about that down the road. We don't have to worry about it now. But I just wanted to give you an idea of who Schrodinger is. He was one of the big players. So this is what he wrote. Without intending it, indeed almost without noticing, the researcher simplifies the problem of understanding nature by ignoring or removing his or her own person, the knowing subject, from the world under investigation. In particular, and most importantly, this is the reason that the viewpoint of natural science has nothing to do with ethics and ethical values, nothing to say about concerning our own destiny. I wasn't sure how to translate, or our decisions, our final goal, and, if I may say, no God. I don't know where I've come from. I don't know where I'm going. Science cannot tell us why music moves us or why an old song can move us to tears. Again, the standpoint that science is an objective discipline, independent of the person of the scientist and independent, really, of any means for establishing values. We are, of course, going to look at another point of view. Pauli is trying to come up with a point of view in contrast to that. How? By seeing, we will be seeing that underneath his theoretical physical theories, he is trying to find the images that occur in his dreams prior to their creation. So he feels that all physical theories are actually archetypal images, or are based on archetypal images that are subsequently elaborated into a rational theory. But underneath the rational theory is a non-rational process of discovery that led to that theory. And by the scientists looking at the images that occur in their work, that's where they can begin to feel and evaluate what they're doing and to see the personal relevance of their work to their own growth. Does that make sense? It's a brand new attempt to get science out of what most scientists would call its essentially objective nature.
So you're saying that when he has an image, he hopes to see how that image speaks about science and speaks about his own personal growth at the same time.
Right, right. The fundamental process in an artist or a scientist is the image or the dream. And it's no different. And just as an artist can feel and evaluate their life and their time through their art, so can a scientist if they're able to work at this deeper level of the image which precedes the theory. They would say, well, we are just trying to explain data. But Pauli's position is, but that interpretation itself is a mental process. And that is guided by something within the scientists. And that's the archetype. It's kind of a very important idea, I think. So, see, he was trying to feel the relationship between his scientific work and his own development.
Gary, yeah. Is there a finite number of archetypes, or I mean, I know it comes in different images, but can we back to, I mean...
It's a good question. I don't know. I'm just not sure how to answer that. You know, there are, maybe if you want to give yourself a working answer, I think there are main archetypes. In other words, there are archetypes that appear a lot. Mother, father, God, earth, matter, light, major dimensions of our experience. But I would, I'm not sure how to give you a complete answer there. Let me read you that last paragraph and then see where Carl wants to go. Schrödinger was convinced, I believe, that this simplification is inevitable for science. Now, that's Schrödinger and Einstein we've heard too, two of the big players.
Simplification? That seems more complicated.
I think simplification in the sense that, the person of the scientist is removed from science.
Oh.
There's a quote which I have tried to find and I have not been able to track it down. I heard it once on a PBS show. The guy who, I forget exactly what he did. He was instrumental in one of the, you know, sub-discoveries that led to the atomic bomb, Enrico Fermi. Do you remember exactly what he did? He produced the first, I think he produced the first chain reaction in a test tube. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you know, it wasn't a bomb, but he showed that it is, in theory, practical to produce a chain reaction on a teensy, teensy, teensy little scale. But it gave them then the confidence to continue pursuing it on a larger scale. And somebody said, you know, don't you feel bad? And he made this utterly arrogant statement about, you know, what people do with my work is of no concern to me. So that's the coldness of science that Pauli is trying to address. That's an extreme. I wish I could find that quote to truly document it, but I haven't been able. It was either an interview with Weisskopf, the chemist, or Kistiokowski. No, Weisskopf, the physicist, or Kistiokowski, the chemist, or whatever, but I haven't been able to find it. So the life of Wolfgang Pauli shows, however, that an involvement with the inner world is surely vital for a scientist. So that's how we are making a shift here. How can we look at this major activity of science and not exclude the person of the scientist? Because up to now, no one has done it. That's why I think it's so important. And if you not all of you would necessarily be interested in science. So if you find that a dry idea, just substitute in there technology or building subdivisions or building highways. It's this the attitude of Western activity, technological, scientific activity, that thinks it is proceeding objectively and that there is in that system really no set of values for guiding how that technology develops the society, builds the neighborhood, builds the road, builds the building, tears down a neighborhood, and so on. It's about our Western activity. So if the word science leaves you a little cold, you can substitute. Our whole Western way of manipulating and building up the earth, that's what's being addressed here. Up to now, there's been no work done on how does that relate to the psyche. So we're trying to extend what we know about dream work, what we know about the relationship of the psyche and the artist to the relationship between either a technocrat or a scientist or a politician, for that matter, in their dealings with the applying Western technical tools to, quote-unquote, improve our life. And that's what Pauli is about. Versus Einstein, versus Schrodinger, Pauli is trying to find how his inner world relates to the science. That's why I have to like the guy. Because he took up a problem that no one ever addressed before.
Minor quote. This statement here that the first intimation of natural science, which is not possessed by pure intellect, rather as science that is turned toward the light of nature. He certainly...
Yeah, I stand correct.
Modest,
but important.
Especially in light of Jung's appreciation of Goethe, I think. And I don't think our author here was necessarily, and Erkland's maybe necessarily familiar with it, which is kind of odd.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about that. It's actually not off the point. Are you all aware of the role of Faust in Jung's life?
Sort of. I mean, I've read.
Shall I spend a little time on it? I don't want to repeat it if you know it. I got this straight from the horse's mouth. His grandson told me that Jung felt his whole life was a penance for Faust. It's a pretty strong statement. And over Balingen, you know, Jung carved that... I don't know if I can remember it in Latin. Fausti Penitentia. Don't tell me more than Sacrum Fausti Penitentia. You'll see how this bears on what Tom was saying in a second. Sacrum. Don't hold me to the exact spelling. No one on shrine, Faust's penitence. Let's talk a little bit about Faust. Faust. It's a two-volume work written by Goethe, like the German Shakespeare, sort of, I guess you could say. In which Faust first makes a deal with the devil to seduce a woman. I'm making it very simple. And by the end of the story, everybody's dead. Make a long story short. Now, Faust is not dead, but his love affair is disastrous. The girl kills herself, her brother is killed. And it's written when Goethe was young. Part two was written when he was an old man. And it's the same kind of deal, but Faust and the devil again are together. And they're off doing all sorts of greedy things. And at the end of the book, Faust starts feeling guilty, and he says, my whole life has been, in effect, something that caused suffering to others. I'm going to do something good for a change. So it's amazing. It's an amazing story, speaking of Tom's relevance of Tom's comment. He decides to build condos. Imagine, this isn't like the 18th century. He decides to recover land from the sea and put up housing, public housing. I guess it was apparently a reference to in Denmark when they were, Holland. They were recovering, you know, some of the marshy lands and extending the boundaries of the country, and that's the immediate reference. Well, in building the condos, there's an old couple living on the beach, Philemon and Baucis. Philemon. And I don't, were they killed or they were killed? There's an old couple living in a hut in the beach where the land was being recovered. And as a result of an accident, I guess, or whatever, they end up getting killed. So once again, Faust messes up. But Jung saw Faust as an image of the Western intellect. the Western scientific enterprise, the Western technical drive. He's the power of a Western accomplishment, which is horribly destructive. We don't care to see it, but that's why we have poets. Philemon and Baucis, where is an allusion to ancient Greek mythology. They were an old couple living in the forest, and Zeus and Hermes sought a night shelter, traveling incognito. And the old couple gave Zeus and Hermes a night's stay. And in the morning, the gods revealed themselves as who they were. And they offered Philemon and Baucis, Philemon's the man, Baucis is the woman, anything they wanted for their hospitality, for repayment of their hospitality. And what they wanted was to spend eternity together. That was their wish. So when they died, the gods turned them into two entwining trees so they could be together forever. Well, that's what Goethe says Western power kills. And the way Jung put it was they represent that place where the heart stays open and the gods enter in. Faust would represent the idea where there's a will, there's a way. And Jung felt his whole psychology was an attempt to do penance for that Western error. Also the area of Freudian psychology. Puts the ego first. And to give it a thumbnail expression, what Jung tried to do was find a way to live, find a way, find the way, and then the will follow. So it's a reversal of centrality. The will serves the way. The will doesn't make the way. But Faust is what Einstein said. Faust is what Schrodinger said. This idea that activity is separate from the person of who does it, from any emotional relationship, and it's separate from any values of consideration. And that's why it's been, that's why the West has been so destructive. Not that it hasn't accomplished a lot, it has. But what lies problematic in those accomplishments might now be our very downfall if we don't address it. So ironically, like Toynbee says, the success of a civilization is what brings it down. So that's where Pauli's coming from. I think Tom is right. Yeah, Goethe, certainly in writing that story, gave very clear articulation to the problem. And now Pauli and Jung first, I think, and Pauli are trying to find another basis for research, for work, for understanding, for what is done, for what is not done, and for how it is done in science, technology, and any application that uses knowledge to manipulate the environment. It's a very, of course, very first start, full of many problems, but I think it, that doesn't mean it's not worthy of study. And that's why I think this is so important. So, yeah, Tom's point is well taken. First Goethe, Jung, and now Pauli. I think Pauli was the first guy who came to Jung who was really seriously both a scientist and wanting to address deeper issues, not being content with a Schrodinger or a Einstein point of view.
Minor application.
Yeah.
In addition to poetry and all sorts of essays and fiction and such, Goethe did actually practice of a Naturwissenschaft, natural science or whatever.
Alchemist.
He basically did that as well. Studied that as a young lad. But one of the, and all of this obviously influenced all of his writings, but one thing, I guess I want to make, because it ties into Eileen's question about archetypes and different things in a little bit, but that, you know, he, in his scientific studies, tried to design a methodology that would allow the person of the observer to merge, if you will, with the object of observation, and to do away with that subject-object differentiation. And, you know, when he's talking to his friend Schiller about Friedrich Schiller late in life, and he's talking about the Urpflanzen and the archetypal plants that you could see these, and Schiller said, well, that sounds like you can see ideas. And Goethe says, well, very well then, I can see ideas. And it was kind of asserted that. So, I don't know, this ties in a little bit to try to amplify the point here, making that, well, we're making here that there was a tendency in that dramatic sort of rational Western approach that was started by an artist, picked up then by a doctor, and then picked up furthermore by a scientist. And it still has tremendous relevance for us today, because if you read any of these books on the new physics and stuff like that, they're all talking about this stuff, but few of them, this kind of merger of subject and object, but few of them actually mention Goethe. It's a pity.
Great, thank you. I'll go on, then we'll see what Carol wants to say. Against his own will, Pauli was confronted with a dimension of his personality which revealed a mixture of good and evil, light and shadow, and which bore witness to a deep split between spirit and instinct. That's both in him personally, and then we'll see how he began to see that same split in science. The healing of this split is thus a precondition for the development of a natural science that does not separate matter and spirit from one another and does not dominate matter with the help of the spirit. So Pauli's own personal version of the split is his difficulty with power versus love. And that's paralleled by the scientific attitude, which is really about domination of matter through knowledge. How would we relate to matter if we didn't try to dominate it, is the question. In Pauli's dreams, we find the first intimation of a science, natural science, which is not possessed by the pure intellect. Rather, a science that is turned toward the light of nature, the knowledge of nature, which makes itself known in dream images and in the imagination. We'll be talking about this light of nature stuff a lot, so don't worry if it doesn't make sense. But basic idea is that there is another way of knowing besides the rational intellect. In other words, there are different types of knowledge. And to solve this problem, we are going to have to discover another type of knowing. And that's what's going on in Pauli's psyche, an attempt to give him as an individual the faculty of knowing in a new way.
You know, Gary, I just read, I was trying to find the study information on our vision seminar, but I just looked at your papers, and I read the one on von Franz, the one you wrote on von Franz. Is that kind of what you're talking about, the way she, where you said that she was an authority figure?
That kind of knowledge is terribly powerful. But it is not authoritarian. It's authority without being authoritarian. I'd never had that experience before. And it is a qualitatively different emotional experience. Well, it changed my life, I gotta tell you. I have never met anyone like that. It's actually a good example. I think you felt that a little bit in the video. I don't know if you could feel that, and I felt, because I know her. I mean, I didn't know her, but I had contact with her.
The video
that we saw over at Nancy's, I guess you went there.
Oh.
Actually, I have a DVD of it if you want to borrow it.
Oh.
Could you feel that sense in her? She was not coming from power. So you weren't activated in power. Yet, you wouldn't want to write a bad paper for her.
No.
Or you'd only write one,
right? I know it's because of what she's motivated by, right? When she was trying to help you find your creative side,
yeah.
Which was coming from a whole different place.
A whole different place.
We experience, because they're wanting to manipulate us.
Yeah.
And so that's...
It's a big difference. It's all about power, you could say, from this moment. Although Pali himself was not capable, I'm sorry to say, of following this path. I got a typo there. He left us in his record of his inner experience a fascinating and inspiring document. And then we can, as a in a mirror, glimpse the suffering of our techno-rational time. We've talked about how what he did and didn't do. We'll be looking at that. Carol.
Okay. Here he says that in the middle of that paragraph, natural science that does not separate, well, matter and spirit from one another and does not dominate matter with the help of spirit. Mm-hmm. In the next sentence, he goes on and says, we must find a natural science which is not possessed by the pure intellect. So here he's identifying intellect with spirit. But then he doesn't go on to explain to the reader who might not know that that's a mistake. Jung calls that a mistake because he says that's not really spirit, that's intellect.
I have to check the German.
I see what he's saying here, but he doesn't go into that whole thing that Jung talks about where he says, no, the spirit is not the intellect.
Yeah, but in German it's the same word. That might be where it's confusing. I got to see how I...
So maybe we don't want to use the word spirit here.
No, I think, yeah, we do. Because in English you have to make that distinction, but... I don't think he's implying anything incorrect. He's saying that first there's the spirit. Are you all aware of this, how Jung derives the intellect out of the spirit? Should we talk about that? Or do you know that?
Well, he says that's a modern mistake to identify.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if other people are with me on that. No. Okay. Well, the original idea, first of all, the problem is in German it's the same word for spirit and mind, Geist. And culture, they're all the same word. And the idea is that originally the mind, the Geist, was not rational. The medieval mind, he's talking about here, was completely comfortable with paradox. And contradiction and ambiguity. And you find that even more in pre-literate cultures, where the mind is really an organ of imagination as much as anything that counts beans. And Jung's idea, that is really what the human mind is. And we have turned it into a logical processing machine since the scientific revolution. So intellect is but one feature of the mind, and it has cut out the true nature of what mind is. In other words, that we have lost touch with what the human mind really is by saying it's the intellect. Now, in Pali, you'll certainly see that that guy had a mind, which means he could compute and he could image. So at its best, that's what the mind is. There's not a distinction between linear and nonlinear cognition. It's only the narrow-minded prejudice of our time that wants to make that distinction.
So he's saying spirit is equally an aspect of the mind.
better to say the mind, well, the mind and spirit are the same thing.
Okay, yeah.
Spirit, intellect is a subcategory of mind in its original human, in our original human nature. But we have made intellect to mean mind. Does that make sense?
Well, it does.
Yeah.
But I still don't get, then, in other words, spirit and mind, we're using Jungian talk to say spirit and mind in the same way.
Yeah.
But we don't want to make the mistake of saying spirit equals our intellect. Period.
Right. Right. Or intellect equals spirit.
Which is what we come to do.
Yeah.
And I thought that that should be made clear here if the reader was going to understand.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, Carol. And let me make a note there. I'll check the German. Do you have a pencil I can borrow? I'm going to take your only pencil, man. Do you have another one? No, I need, I just brought one, but.
Here's Carol.
Okay, can I keep this for the. Please. I think I did this last time, too, didn't I? See, I'm trying to get out of my intellect. That's what I'm I'll just check that, Carol. Remember that little instance where that there was, I guess, a certain psych professor who actually had the courage to leave a certain university here because she was told not to teach Jung.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at Butler. And one of the psych professors was told by the chair, don't teach Jung. This has been a while ago.
Oh, it wasn't.
Oh, it's maybe 15 years ago, yeah.
There used to be one that taught that.
She did
Wisner?
No, this is at Butler. He was at CTS.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
But she could teach Freud.
I don't know about that. I don't know. All I know is she left. And what he said was, it's not scientific.
Freud is.
I don't know about Freud. That's a good question. But you see how that, well, you see the presuppositions behind that statement, that the only valid knowledge is intellect. So when you read these things, it sounds like maybe we're just discussing philosophical niceties, but it really plays out in the evolution of one person's career, at least. And God knows how many students are not getting exposed to this stuff thanks to that prejudice. So it really does work in the way we live. Okay. Any questions? Well, page 23. Yeah, he spent the war in Princeton. Oppenheimer was his student. Oppenheimer was the guy who chaired the Manhattan Project. Pauli did not take part in it. Now comes an interesting development, I think. And again, as I said, maybe I should keep saying it, I will be trying to feel into what is right about Pauli and what's wrong about him. This, is, I think, is part of his genius. And really courage. As in Austria during the First World War, see where I am there? This is a letter to von Franz. In the year 1945, while I stayed in America, I suddenly had the distinct feeling that I lived in a criminal atmosphere. That was at the time when the atomic bombs had been dropped on Japan. My anima got very irritated and had outbursts of anger till I departed from the USA. If you think, I don't know, if you're familiar with the history of the bomb and all that happened after the bomb, the way they went after Oppenheimer, J. Edgar Hoover put a vendetta on Oppenheimer and was tried for being a communist, brought before the House on whatever it is, committee on for being communist, part of McCarthy era.
House of American Activity.
Arthur Miller was called before them. He refused to testify and was arrested for contempt of Congress. Oppenheimer did testify and was banned from any further government work, essentially calling them communists. They went after the very people who had saved them. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Because Oppenheimer had, at that time, remember, Russia was our allies, some Russians working on the bomb project. And because of that, he was declared a communist. It's absolutely, it is one of the saddest chapters in our history, except for the present one. But it just shows you how Pauli was picking up on that. We, as Americans, think, well, it had to be this way, it had to be that way. But his psyche couldn't stand it, and he left. He went back to Zurich, took up his chair again at theoretical physics. Now comes the sentence which is relevant to our enterprise here. If you go to that paragraph before the quote, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up. Though once back in Switzerland, Pauli was again plagued by an inner uncertainty. That's when these dreams are going to start. He was distressed at what science had achieved. As is evident in his letter to von Franz, he was happy again to be in a country that did not take part in the Second World War. Though he could not deny that his science of physics had played a deciding role in the war. And he writes, I feel myself relatively well to be back in Switzerland, where at least the people and the country are not involved in this kind of collective guilt, neither in the First World War nor the use of the atom bomb in 1945. My time of transition began after the First World War. My weak and bad relationship to Mother Earth has a lot to do with this pacifist complex, and I hope now that this has found more of its earth, I'm again settled here. Yet now something perhaps worse has arisen. Certainly my geographical surroundings are not mired in guilt, but certainly my profession, physics, is. So it's out of this guilt now these dreams are going to come. Now again, this next paragraph I just think is terrific. Again, why I like the guy. Because if you tell this to people, you'll say, well, what science? Science didn't drop the bomb. So stop moaning, he'll say. My conscious attitude is that it is unreasonable to give up physics. Bottom of 23. It is unreasonable to give up physics because of the political and military experiences. Science is not responsible for the uses to which it is put by others. Indeed, these uses can always be to the useful or the harmful. That's what you'll hear if you discuss these ideas with a lot of people, particularly scientists. Now, but the unconscious, the anima, holds a different view. And so I think what we're going to be looking at is his attempt to hear the standpoint of the feminine in response to the beginning of the nuclear age. It seems she is, in this regard, developing resistances against physics, and will see to it that I cease having creative ideas, or at least fewer of them. So what that means is that he knew his anima had a different point of view about this stuff. And he could go along with collective thinking, and he could say, well, it's the military's problem, it's the politician's problem, it's the industrialist's problem, but that would not change the fact that he would cease to be creative because his anima was in disagreement with him. So his attempt now to turn back to these dreams is an attempt to hear the feminine. And I think it's a very good example of what it means for a man to begin trying to serve the feminine. It doesn't mean making chicken soup. It doesn't mean cooking muffins. It means going to the standpoint of that inner feminine figure, trying to understand it, and then basing what one does in life on that standpoint. And that's what Pauli is at least trying to do. It doesn't make rational sense. But that's the nature of the unconscious. Will the new experience in 1945 prompt me towards a spiritual development that leads away from physics in the narrower sense? Yes, the answer will be yes. Perhaps such a step has already been consolidated. So that what the Adam is asking Pauli to do is turn away from the way he had previously done science and begin articulating these issues and these problems and what he was finding out about them within himself to the general public, which he didn't do. Or he did a little bit of, but kind of in a half-hearted way. Perhaps such a step has already been constellated. You know, you can be sure it has. I know it is a question of fate that in the end is something beyond my decision.
My question is, when we talked last week, you told me to remind you about the seed, the idea of the seed that we had in that. That if it hadn't been Pauli, wouldn't it have been somebody else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's now our job.
Okay.
I think that's, again, why I feel it's not too much to ask you to try to study this sometimes obscure work. Because this is our task. The collective unconscious has a point of view. It picked Pauli to try to get that point of view articulated for many reasons, some we can understand and some which just will make you sick of the guy. He didn't do it. But these ideas that are coming to him are the ideas of the unconscious, not his unconscious. And it's still in there, and I think it's the work of future generations now to try to understand what was going on in him, partly for the sheer fun of understanding a psychological case study, but also the greater issue of what is the standpoint of the unconscious vis-a-vis the problem of our time, and how are we going to articulate it, and who's going to have the courage to articulate it. That's why I think ultimately this is so important. After 1945, Pauli once more began a long time of transition, where he would be pressed by dream figures to develop a wider understanding of nature. That's what's going to be happening. So what we saw here in terms of time, that's just one dimension of this new knowledge, or new type of knowledge, that the unconscious sees as needing to be brought into harmony with the prevailing Western scientific viewpoint, Western scientific technical viewpoint. And we're going to see these images. We're going to see this new way of looking at things personified by dream images. So I think what we're seeing, you know, if you can imagine you were back in Newton's time or you were back in the alchemist's time and there was a new worldview going to come from the alchemist's time where they were forced to realize the earth wasn't the center of the universe. And in Newton's time where they had to realize that causality is no longer valid. We are looking in Pauli's unconscious of images of the next standpoint in a very crude way, but I don't know how much we'll be able to understand about it, but that's what's going on, I think. A new worldview is in preparation. The next worldview is in preparation. I guess the next point there in that paragraph, just to mention, is how important Pauli was in the world of physics and what his voice could have meant. As they said there at the dinner celebration honoring Pauli's Nobel Prize, which was given in 1945 during the war. He was in Princeton, and they had a dinner for him at Princeton because he couldn't travel to Stockholm because of the war. And it was at that moment that Einstein sort of passed the mantle on to Pauli and said, you're next, buddy. He was like a king who was abdicating, showing Pauli was really the leader of the scientific enterprise at the time, Einstein thought. Let's have a stretch.